Psychological operations, military deception, information operations are not new. They've been around since biblical times. What's new, of course, is the conduct of those activities in this relatively new warfighting domain of cyberspace. We've got to be agile because the information environment, cyberspace, is changing all the time. There's a new piece of malware on the street every 7 to 12 seconds.
G'day, welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Catherine Manstead, and this is the podcast that looks at national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. This podcast is brought to you by policyforum.net and the National Security College at the ANU. Now, those comments you just heard were from Major General Marcus Thompson, and we will be back to hear more from him right after this message.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So today on the National Security Podcast, we're very privileged to have the head of the Australian Defence Forces Information Warfare Division, Major General Marcus Thompson, who was in fact the inaugural head of that division, having been appointed to the role in 2017. Before that, Major General Marcus Thompson has served in the ADF for over 30 years and deployed on a number of occasions overseas. He's not just a soldier, but also a scholar with multiple master's degrees and a PhD in cybersecurity. And just a reminder that due to the ongoing pandemic, we are not in the studio today, so those accustomed to high standards of audio quality from the National Security Podcast will need to bear with us. As soon as things open back up, we will of course return to the studio. But in the meantime, let's continue our chat with Marcus Thompson. Major General Thompson, welcome to the National Security Podcast.
G'day, Catherine. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I thought I'd start with an easy question to ease us into this game, and that is around the notion of the term information warfare. I suppose to the average Aussie, IW, information warfare, could sound a little Orwellian at first glance. How would you describe what it is that your division is setting out to do in everyday language?
Oh, goodness me, Catherine, there's a bit to that. Look, when the division was created in 2017, my marching orders at the time were to grip up cyber, electronic warfare, intelligence, information operations, command and control, and bring all of those military functions together into something coherent that could be used by the Chief of Joint Operations. And that was for two very good reasons. One is it was, you know, as many of your listeners will recall, it was a key recommendation out of the First Principles Review from 2015 that identified that some of these capabilities perhaps that don't neatly sit within the Navy, the Army, or the Air Force, that some of those capabilities might not have received the attention that they. That they were due, but secondly, perhaps more importantly, it's a reflection of the character of contemporary conflict that information is at the centre of everything we do. Now, some would argue that that's always been the case, that psychological operations, that military deception, that information operations are not new. They've been around since biblical times. What's new, of course, is the conduct of those activities in this relatively new warfighting domain of cyberspace.
Can I just ask then, so we've had, I'm not very good at maths, 2017, this is the third year then of the life of IW. Perhaps could you detail for us some of the hurdles or challenges in that time that have been important to coalesce all of these functions together, the cyber, the EW, and really group them up, or indeed some of the biggest changes that have occurred as a result of the new division coming into existence?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I'll start by saying change is hard, and the creation of Information Warfare Division and its positioning, within the Australian Defence Force headquarters, was welcomed by some, and quite frankly, at the time, resisted by others. I have on my wall in my office a quote from Niccolo Machiavelli that says that the innovator has for enemies all those who did well under the old system, but lukewarm defenders in those who might do well under the new. And that was certainly my experience as we stood up Information Warfare Division and sought to re-energise these information-related capabilities for the Australian Defence Force that, quite frankly, had atrophied over some years. And of course, in this day and age, with the proliferation of technology, the real emergence of threats and opportunities in cyberspace, of course, it puts us in a complex policy environment and a complex capability environment. And of course, it should be no surprise to anyone that there were both supporters and detractors when we stood up in 2017. I'll say, I mean, I've said this publicly, I don't mind saying it again, that when we stood up in 2017, there were people in senior people in defence who thought that the Australian Defence Force had no role to play in cyberspace. And you asked me about what has changed, the big changes in the past 3 years. Well, I'd say it's that. I mean, there is now no doubt that the Australian Defence Force has a role to play in cyberspace. And in fact, having cyber capabilities within the Australian Defence Force is essential for the Australian Defence Force to survive, fight and win in the contemporary battle space.
It's interesting you say that. At first, perhaps it was thought cyber sat somewhere outside of defence. Increasingly, it seems that a lot of maybe what we would call unconventional threats are coming into the mandate and mission of the ADF, and information and cyber capabilities are obviously one big bucket of unconventional threats. But, I mentioned in the intro that we're all at home at the moment because of the coronavirus, and Australia this year has faced a number of different unconventional threats in the security space, not least of which is the ongoing COVID-19 crisis. But of course, we are still in a recovery phase from a really significant bushfire crisis over the end of 2019 and 2020. And those two crises together, I think, have sparked a lot of debate in Australia about what national security is, and also the role of the ADF. Both crises, the ADF has been involved in the bushfires, particularly in the recovery phase, and also now with COVID-19, we've seen the ADF asked by the government to help out with some quarantine procedures and even some manufacturing of key goods. From someone who is not necessarily in those two areas, but is responsible for coordinating the ADF's response to a huge area of unconventional threats. And threats, as you said before, which touch not just on the geopolitical stuff, but also kind of on the real world stuff of technology and how people use it. Are there lessons that you are drawing right now in real time from these two big crises and Australia's response to them this year?
Oh, there's plenty of lessons being captured and applied on a minute by minute, if not day by day basis at the moment. But it's a cracking question that you raise, Catherine, and it's one that has been on my mind for some time, and that is, what is the role, or what are the expectations of the Australian Defence Force in defending the homeland, defending Australia in the information environment and in cyberspace? I mean, I was asking that question well before these most recent crises that you referred to, of the bushfires and the COVID-19 crisis as well. And of course, we've seen through the bushfires and we've seen through the COVID-19 response, an increasing trend, if you like, for the Australian Defence Force to be used as part of the national response. And I'll say up front that the men and women of the Australian Defence Force who participated in that bushfire response and are still participating in the bushfire recovery and are literally, as we speak, supporting in some way, shape, or form the national response to the COVID-19 crisis, that to a person, they are loving it because it's one of those rare occasions where members of the ADF actually get to deploy in support of Australians. Normally, and certainly my experience has been, you know, we'd deploy to some other part of the world and to help a foreign people. As important a task as that is, supporting Australians is a rare privilege. And I know that all of the members of the ADF who are currently deployed in a domestic setting are acutely aware of that. But it does make me wonder, it does just cause me to keep asking the question about, you know, what might the expectations of the ADF be in what might be a cyber Pearl Harbor, I think was the phrase that the Secretary of Home Affairs, Mike Pezzullo, used during our Senate estimates hearing last year, during 2019. I just wonder what the expectations might be, because, of course, there are sensible and appropriate constitutional and legal constraints around using the military in a domestic setting. Yeah, these are entirely sensible, entirely appropriate constraints. But I do just wonder, if we think about a large scale, beyond your normal run-of-the-mill cybersecurity events, and some of that makes the news and some of it doesn't. But I do wonder if the threat came at scale, to use Secretary Pezzullo's phrase, a cyber Pearl Harbor, what might the expectations of the ADF be? Now, I don't have a view, Catherine, but I do think it's a fascinating question, and I do think it's an important question for the nation to and interested strategists and policymakers to discuss.
Can I just draw you out on that for a moment? So the notion of a cyber Pearl Harbor, that is a term that's been thrown around. The earliest I think I can find is the mid-1990s in the US with fears of an imminent cyber Pearl Harbor. And these fears have never eventuated. Now, I know that if you read the tea leaves, there seems to be an uptick in states using cyber to achieve strategic effects. But is the notion of this kind of we're about to, at some point, we could fall off a cliff and have a major cyber attack perpetuated against us, is that a slightly overblown fear? Or to put it another way, if we're not afraid of, a state would need to have a clear reason in order to a nation state, in order to aggress against Australia in such a significant way. Should we be focusing our efforts on cyber Pearl Harbors, or are the actual threats perhaps less sexy than a Pearl Harbor, but things like disinformation or just own goals from poor cyber hygiene, are they equally or if not more important?
Oh, I think they're all important. I mean, you just made the comment that a cyber Pearl Harbor hasn't occurred. Well, Pearl Harbor hadn't occurred until Pearl Harbor occurred. And I don't think that's just because something hasn't occurred doesn't mean that we shouldn't consider the possibility and consider what our response might be in such a circumstance. Is that more important than run-of-the-mill cybersecurity or what some people refer to as cyber hygiene? No, that's just as important. Is the threat of misinformation and fake news also valid and important? Well, I think that kind of speaks for itself. There's plenty of commentary in open source media about disinformation and misinformation, if you like. But I will say again, this is not new, and the pursuit of influence is not the sole domain of malign foreign actors. I mean, marketers use particular techniques to generate a purchasing behavior. Advertisers seek to generate a particular behavior by inducing responses through particular messaging. And of course, with the seemingly exponential growth of cyberspace and use of cyberspace, is those actions from the likes of advertisers and marketers can be quite specific and geographically and demographically, and that can easily design content that might only be seen by a particular age group, from a particular employment group, with a particular political leaning in a particular location. We see advertisers doing that. I think it's probably reasonable that we think about how malign foreign actors might use similar techniques.
Can I just draw you out on that for a moment? I think it's interesting that you point out that a lot of the wrinkles in the information environment that we have are caused not just by technology, but also by the business models of technology makers and technology users that sit on top of that. And so if, we're talking about disinformation and micro-targeting, as you were alluding to here, the canonical case of Russian interference in US politics, particularly around the 2016 presidential election, but on an ongoing basis, a lot of that, Russian trolls took America as they found it and used to great effect the algorithms of social media and the digital breadcrumbs that people leave behind in their ordinary interactions online, commercial and social interactions. I guess there's a question here around the way in which our information environment is structured is kind of based on information and data harvesting, and also to a large extent a bit of manipulation, whether that's commercial actors trying to get you to buy something or watch, and binge watch Netflix, which might be a sensitive issue to some of us facing quarantine at the moment, the way in which the digital ecosystems channel us to do things that maybe our better selves wouldn't want us to do. But you're sitting in the military piece of this. A lot of these things that we're talking about, the business models of internet giants, the tendency of digital technologies to manipulate people, that is not a military thing. That's a social and an economic policy thing. So how do you, as someone sitting in the ADF, reconcile or indeed engage on some of these questions? Because to me it seems kind of important that we first understand how maybe domestic and legitimate domestic actors, politicians, advertisers use and maybe abuse the information environment. And because one, that sets the conditions for, foreign agents or actors to exploit that. And two, it also creates just the broader information environment in which we operate, which, as you said, has both opportunities but also vulnerabilities. What's your approach to consulting or informing or engaging across different portfolios and some of these really tricky multi-dimensional issues?
Well, we all share the same information environment. And so, it's the information environment doesn't recognize whatever stovepipe that someone might reside in. And it does, from a national security perspective, it certainly dictates a close coordination and a tight interagency approach. And I think the Australian national security community is pretty good in this regard. I mean, it is clear that the Department of Home Affairs is the policy lead for information environment for cyber. It is clear that the Australian Signals Directorate, that of course includes the Australian Cyber Security Centre, is the lead agency from a national perspective for cybersecurity. If I'm fully understanding the premise of your question, I think we're pretty well linked up from a national security community perspective here in Australia. But that said, we've got to keep at it. We've got to be diligent to seams between our respective portfolios. We've got to be agile because the information environment, cyberspace is changing all the time. I read something recently that there's a new piece of malware on the street every 7 to 12 seconds. So in that environment, we've just got to keep talking to each other and keep working with each other. And I think we're pretty good at that.
You mentioned the national security agencies, though. I guess my question was going to, as well, issues of economic policy, social policy, competition policy, some of that broader media policy, some of that broader, softer stuff, which we've never really traditionally thought of and perhaps rightly thought of through a security lens. Is there a need for more kind of cohesion or collaboration across those broader sectors, not just kind of Home Affairs to ASD to ONI, but more broadly, this whole of, to use a very hollowed out and overused term, but more of a whole of government approach to some of these issues? And how do you sensitively approach that as the defence guys coming into areas which are kind of more traditionally something that defence would not be a part of?
Yeah, well, I don't think that national power is necessarily a foreign concept for departments and agencies beyond the national security community. I mean, I think many of your listeners, Catherine, would be aware of the DIME construct for national power: diplomacy, information, military, economic, and of course, economic there's departments of state and agencies that contribute to that. Military, obviously led by the Department of Defense, but other agencies, other departments of state contribute. Diplomacy, clearly a Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade lead, where there's clearly a requirement for close interagency collaboration is in the eye with information, because we don't have a Department of State dedicated to the eye in DIME.
So this seems as good as any time to take a break. We will be back in just a moment for more about all things information and cyber with Major General Marcus Thompson on the National Security Podcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
You said around the notion of the bushfire and COVID-19 responses that your sense is that there's a great deal of pride in the ADF and in those members who are currently serving in those areas, because for the first time in a long time, there's a tangible connection between what they're doing and supporting Australians on the home front. And it occurs to me that in the domains of cyber and information, these are very much uniquely areas which touch the lives of ordinary citizens. It's the ordinary citizen who, if there's an attack on critical infrastructure, whose life is seriously disrupted. It's the ordinary citizen who is potentially reading and consuming disinformation that is part of a concerted state-driven campaign and having their psychology in some way deliberately exploited. Now, it occurs to me that in some way it's not new, because certainly we've had periods in history before where the home front has been very much a centre of gravity for conflict and competition. But it's a bit different. And for Australians in particular, who have, our experience of warfare over the last 20 years or even beyond as small wars overseas, which we haven't had much of a personal stake in, is there a need for, to engage people more on the cyber and information issues? And is there a risk that people's expectations, understandings of what war is and what competition and conflict is in the 21st century hasn't yet caught up with this reality that sees them so inextricably linked to it?
Yeah. Look, I mean, that's a cracking question. I mean, I would say that I have real faith in the Australian community and in Australian citizens to understand this space. Where I've been, one of the other questions, I mean, I mentioned earlier that one of the key questions I've been asking is about the role of the ADF in this space. One of the other questions I've been asking is, how do we have sensible public discussions about this? Because a lot of this discussion necessarily and appropriately is classified and so can't be routinely shared with the public. And I think Australians understand that and respect that as much as I'm sure thinking people will be curious. I mean, that's why I'm prepared to do a podcast such as this, Catherine, so we can be having public discussions, and we have seen I think an increase in that public discussion over the last year or so. You know, Chief of Defence Force has made some public comments. The former Director General of the Australian Signals Directorate, Mike Burgess, now the head of ASIO, had some public engagements last year, and I think these are all positive outcomes that encourage Australians to think about these things and to think about what capabilities the nation might require and in what circumstances might those capabilities be used.
Let me bring you then to the kind of issues of lexicon and words in this space, because a lot of the ways in which, yes, we're seeing more discussion by military and intelligence and national security leaders about a lot of these issues, but a lot of the words that are being used tend to sometimes obscure, in at least on some views, more than they reveal. So, you know, the CDF spoke about political warfare, which is it's a complex term that I'm not even entirely sure I understand, and it certainly means different things to different people. Information warfare itself, we touched on at the beginning, it can refer to a grab bag of, in some sense, disparate capabilities and activities. So, and cybersecurity is famous for the disjunct between the words that those in the techie community might use and the words that politicians use to describe certain events and everyday mums and dads might use to describe their activities online. Now, I know that your PhD was on lexicography? I don't even know how to pronounce that word. Can you pronounce that word for me? Lexicography.
Taxonomies and ontology.
Taxonomy. So yeah. It was about the meaning of words, I think, and you built out a kind of some definitions and taxonomies around resilience and cyber concepts. So words obviously matter to you as well. How are we doing in terms of Australia, in terms of giving a bit of colour and refinement to all of these new words that we're needing to deal with, from political warfare right down to DDoS attacks and hackers? Are we there yet? And if not, you know, what's our scorecard looking like?
Oh, I think it's a constant struggle, actually. Well, not a struggle, but it's something we just need to keep talking about and refine our understanding. I mean, I took a conscious decision when I came to this job 3 years ago, and that decision has stuck with. I haven't had cause to change it. I took a deliberate decision not to try and define information warfare, because I did not want to spend two or three or so years arguing over semantics. So what we've done is we've described and tried to paint a picture of what information warfare is and what information warfare capabilities are. Now, where I've deviated from that is where it's been important for capability and policy discussions to aid understanding. So, for example, you talked about cybersecurity and language techies use. I mean, I've gone to great pains to delineate and distinguish between cybersecurity and cyber operations in much the same way. I mean, you referred to my doctoral thesis. I went to great pains there to distinguish and delineate between security and resilience. And so, you know, those two distinctions, security, resilience, cybersecurity, cyber operations, there is a relation there. I have a view that security is a binary construct. You know, you're either secure or you're not. Resilience is important after security has failed. It exists on a spectrum, and this is where your minimum standard or minimum quality of service or for continuity of operations comes in, and it is that piece between, you know, security and resilience which maps to that delineation between cybersecurity. You know, what do we do to defend ourselves? What do we do from a set and forget, you know, network hygiene, things we set and forget? But whereas cyber operations, of course, is people, is human beings actually conducting activities to counter threat activity or indeed to project force. Where it's been critical for understanding, we have dived in and gone into greater depth with our definitions and descriptions. But I tell you, I just didn't want to be spending, you know, years arguing in Canberra, you know, between a word and a sentence and, you know, arguing semantics over definitions.
That sounds like a good and sanity-preserving approach, not least because I assume we'll still be quibbling, at least in the academy, over the definitions of these terms for decades to come. I want to just zoom the lens back out even further now and just talk about the difference between the way democracies and more authoritarian-leaning governments experience information warfare and engage in the information contest. There is discussion out there that kind of falls into two camps on this. On one view, democracies, because we are open information systems and tend to be economically and digitally advanced and connected, are quite vulnerable to the tools and tactics of manipulation in the cognitive realm and then cyber attacks in the more technical realm. But on the other hand, democracy is a very resilient system to your kind of the second part of your framework you introduced before, resilient because we have lots of different decentralized actors who can push back against misinformation, who can be brought into the tent to push back against hacks and other malicious cyber activities. So, you know, on the first view, information warfare is perhaps democracy's Achilles heel. And on the other view, actually, information capabilities and cyber capabilities are democracy's magic weapon because it's something that we may have a natural advantage in. Do you have any reflections on kind of inherent differences between how democracies and authoritarians use information and their respective vulnerabilities in our digitized age?
Well, not really. quite frankly, I mean, I made the point earlier that we all share the same information environment. We all use the same cyberspace, and so no matter who we are as individuals, as organisations, as industry sectors, as nations, the information environment, cyberspace, presents threats, vulnerabilities, and opportunities for all of us, and. You know, how we might approach those vulnerabilities or opportunities is a matter for each entity, for each individual, for each organization, for each industry sector, or indeed for each nation. It's a neutral environment. I mean, it's the same operating environment, it's the same cyberspace, it's the same information environment.
That's a fascinating insight. I think I take two things from that. The first is that I should be careful of generalizations, and the second is that your observation about all of us sharing the same information environment has given me a potent mental image of all of the world's leaders kind of swimming together in the same swimming pool. So I thank you for that mental image, which will stay with me for some time. What unfortunately won't stay with us for all time is this podcast, and we are drawing to the end. The way I want to conclude is to ask you two final questions. The first is a bit of a cheeky question, which is, what's the next cyber? And to add a little bit of meat to that, I suppose we often, all of us throughout history, will always suffer from a bit of presentism. We tend to think that whatever is zeitgeisty and hitting the headlines right now is going to be game-changing and forever something that's going to be causing us grief and is going to be a really key focus for our attention. And at the moment, cyber, disinformation, information is a really key focus for a lot of governments around the world and almost, I'd say, dinner table conversation for a lot of people, helped in some part by the popularization of terms like fake news and misinformation by our friends in America. But if you were to be looking out into the future and thinking about the big threats to Australia's national security, or indeed ways to amplify or detract from our national power writ large, where would you be looking that's not necessarily the cyber and information spaces?
Catherine, I suspect my crystal ball is in the same condition as yours. If I knew what the next cyber was, I'd be directing a few dollars to shares in that sector. But I will say, I mean, none of us really know. You know, we can really only speculate where technology might take us. I mean, we're starting to see some exciting developments with artificial intelligence and machine learning. I mean, although to be fair, I mean, most of what we see with artificial intelligence at the moment is the automation of processes that were previously manual. If machine learning really takes off, I mean, the possibilities are endless. Now, and that said, I mean, cyberspace is quite frankly here to stay. We'll see it continue to expand. And of course, we will see it used for both good purposes and indeed for nefarious purposes. And I don't see the requirement for cyber capabilities from a national security perspective going away anytime soon, both defensive and offensive. I think that's only going to become more and more important and more a part of, from a military perspective, more and more part of the contemporary battle space. But I'll tell you what, Catherine, if I have any bright thoughts about where I might put some money in the stock market, I'll let you know.
I'll wait by the phone. Look, that brings me to my final question, which is more of a personal question than a subject matter expert question. And we ask all of our podcast guests this very same question, which is, if you were to reflect over the course of your career, is there a particular moment, a career moment, an event, or indeed a particular thing that you might have read or watched or even a podcast that you listen to that particularly influenced you? And if so, would you be so kind as to share it with our listeners?
Goodness, there's so many moments, so many artifacts that have influenced me over the years, Catherine. But one comes immediately to mind, and I've cited it extensively. It's a futuristic action novel written by August Cole and P.W. Singer called Ghost Fleet, and it was published in 2015, and it was at a time when I was really starting to try and get my head around, you know, what might a cyber war look like. Cole and Singer had produced this book. Some of it, quite frankly, is absolute science fiction, but other aspects of it really got me thinking, and that's a book that I've encouraged anyone with an interest in cyber warfare to read, Ghost Fleet by August Cole and P.W. Singer.
And that dynamic duo has a new book out, I think, in the last month or so, Burn-In, which I haven't yet got my hands on. But Ghost Fleet, certainly, I know for a lot of, for us at the NatSec Pod and also a lot of our listeners, has been also a really impactful book. But I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of dystopia with a silver lining they depict in the next book as well.
Yeah. Look, anything with Singer's name on it is worth reading. I really enjoyed his book. I think it was from about 2013, called Cybersecurity and Cyber Warfare: What Everyone Needs to Know. He wrote that one with, I think it was Alan Friedman, and of course his Like War that he wrote with Emerson T. Brooking, which I think was published maybe about 2 years ago. 18 months ago is also worth a read. Another one recently was David Sanger's book called Perfect Weapon. They've all gone through my hands onto the bookshelf.
None of them particularly cheery titles, though, are they? Like War, Perfect Weapon. I'm seeing a trend here, but nonetheless.
Well, you are speaking to a career soldier, Catherine.
Good soldiery names, good war-y words. Look, thank you so much, General Thompson, for incredibly candid conversation on the National Security Podcast today. A couple of the things I'll be taking away is this notion of the information environment being something that all of us share. There's no national borders in the information domain, but it's also something that, you know, a ripple over here can create a wave perhaps somewhere else, and that's a very graphic concept that will stay with me. But for today, thank you very much, Marcus Thompson, for an incredibly insightful and wide-ranging conversation.
My pleasure, Catherine.
And thank you very much once again to Major General Marcus Thompson for joining us on the National Security Podcast. You can join us too by hitting us up on Twitter. We are at Apps Policy Forum and also at NatSec Pod. You can also join our Facebook group at Policy Forum Pod, or you can use the ye olde personal touch and drop us an email, podcast@policyforum.net. Be sure to hit the subscribe button as well and give us a ranking, hopefully a good one, on whatever platform you pod with. And we will speak to you soon on the next episode of the National Security Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.